The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of any organization, including One Generation Away.
The freedom of a people to choose its leaders is the root of liberty.
Keep alive this experiment in liberty.
Liberty, in case you've forgotten, is the soul's right to breathe.
Government should be very minimal in protecting liberty.
Peace cannot be purchased at the cost of liberty.
The sturdy ground of liberty.
Liberty once lost is lost forever.
Fight for their liberty and for our security.
Guarantees individual liberty.
This great republic, born alone in liberty.
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 Liberty. Just how much do you want liberty?
This is Liberty Nation with Tim Donner. Cutting through the double talk, taking on the topics, going after what the politicians really mean, and making it all clear. For your freedom and your liberty. Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
Is it a legitimate investigation or a witch hunt? Does the Russia investigation signal genuine trouble for President Trump, or is it an overreach of historic proportions? Welcome back into Liberty Nation, and we will discuss the significance of a grand jury impaneled by Special Counsel Robert Mueller this week, and the president's defiant response to the many in D.C. who want to take him down. And while there's not been any evidence revealed of either laws broken or collusion, there is growing evidence in a scandal surrounding the disgraced former head of the Democratic National Committee, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and we will tell you what it is, and Wasserman Schultz's head-shaking response. Meanwhile, the crisis in Venezuela has reached epic proportions, and we'll discuss why Americans should care about it with Nathan Steelwater, military and foreign affairs correspondent for LibertyNation.com. So the noose tightened just a bit more around the neck of Donald Trump and his people this week with word that Special Counsel Robert Mueller has impaneled a grand jury to hear evidence reportedly involving that now infamous meeting between Donald Trump Jr. and a Russian woman promising dirt on Hillary Clinton during the campaign. The meeting, of course, turned out to be just an opportunity for the Russian woman to lobby for getting rid of a law that had nothing to do with Trump or Hillary, but never mind that. The president did what he usually does when he's getting deep-sixed by the D.C. swamp dwellers. He left town and got out among his people, the people who elected him, those forgotten people in the heartland who put him over the top in his shocking victory over Hillary Clinton. And he leveled a blistering attack on those who would use Russia as a pretext for sending him packing.
The Russia story is a total fabrication. It's just an excuse for the greatest loss in the history of American politics. That's all it is. It just makes them feel better when they have nothing else to talk about. What the prosecutors should be looking at are Hillary Clinton's 33,000 deleted emails.
And Trump carried on mocking and ridiculing the people who are aiming political weapons of mass destruction straight at his heart.
There were no Russians in our campaign. There never were. We didn't win because of Russia. We won because of you. That I can tell you. Have you seen any Russians in West Virginia or Ohio or Pennsylvania? They can't beat us at the voting booths. So they're trying to cheat you out of the future and the future that you want. They're trying to cheat you out of the leadership you want with a fake story that is demeaning to all of us, and most importantly, demeaning to our country and demeaning to our Constitution.
All right, so someone is wrong here. Either there was actual collusion between Trump and Russia, which would lead to impeachment in the House and a trial in the Senate, or this is the most ginned-up scandal in American political history. There's nothing in between. There's no nuance. There's no gray area, no middle ground. The logic, if you can call it that, on the left is that because Russia, by most accounts, wanted to see Hillary Clinton lose and by extension Trump win, that all but proves Trump had to be in collusion with nefarious, shadowy Russians. The grand jury now impaneled, reportedly to hear evidence related to the meeting between Donald Trump Jr. and a Russian woman, has put this story back in the headlines. But suppose that this whole thing results in little or nothing. Think about what the anti-Trump forces have put this country through. And we know for a fact that the left literally lost its collective mind when Trump won the election. And they vowed from the moment the election was called to do whatever it takes to remove him from office. And now some weak-kneed Republicans are starting to join the chorus. And Exhibit A is Senator Jeff Flake, a backbench Republican from Arizona. With President Trump's approval numbers sagging, Flake has apparently begun positioning himself for a tough re-election campaign next year by going public with a condemnation of the president of his own party, serving as a self-appointed spokesman for conservatives. Typical politician, abandon a cause or a person when times get tough, cover your backside at the expense of an embattled ally, especially when you're facing re-election. Stick your fingers into a stiff breeze and do what's best for yourself. How quickly so many people have taken their eyes off the prize. How quickly they forget what Trump's victory really meant. Just the fact of Trump's triumph halting Obama's eight-year-long fundamental transformation of America stemmed the progressive tide of history. In fact, it accomplished what Mr. Conservative himself, William F. Buckley, described as the very mission of National Review magazine, the flagship of the conservative movement, to stand athwart history and yell stop. Now, even if he never achieves a single major legislative victory, President Trump already completed much of his mission and that of conservatives on that single fateful day, November 8, 2016. Precisely, where would conservatives be if Trump hadn't won? They would have lost the Supreme Court and the immigration issue and the health care issue for generations, if not forever. They would have seen taxes rise, the regulatory state metastasize, and the rule of law diminish. And they would have lost the culture for good. And yet now, because Trump insists on being the same bombastic, freewheeling, chaos-inducing person in the White House that he was in a campaign that resulted in a historic victory and bailed those conservative and Republicans out, they want to complain? Perhaps Trump's message to Senator Flake and his fellow weak-kneed Republicans should be the political equivalent of what Jack Nicholson said on the witness stand in that famous scene from A Few Good Men.
I have neither the time nor the inclination to explain myself to a man who rises and sleeps under the blanket of the very freedom that I provide and then questions the manner in which I provide it. I would rather you just said thank you and went on your way.
I love that bite. See the, the GOP seal insignia next to the word ingrate at dictionary.com. Okay, it's not actually there, but it should be. The Republican Party and conservatives should be eternally grateful to Donald Trump, whether his administration is chaotic or not, and whether they like him personally or not. Even with virtually no support from congressional Republicans, Trump scored the biggest Republican presidential victory since 1988, turned the GOP from losers into winners, brought millions of new voters into the party, assembled the most conservative cabinet in American history, yes, more conservative than Reagan, and handed his new party full control of the D.C. swamp for the first time in a decade. Little did we know, or maybe we did, that once they gained power, the Republicans would look a gift horse straight in the mouth and fail to themselves deliver even the one thing they'd promised the voters for seven long years, repeal and replacement of Obamacare. So, here's the question. Are they liars or weaklings? And which would be worse? Senator Flake and his fellow travelers in the GOP and conservative establishment wing of the Republican Party complain about the chaos surrounding Trump. At the same time, they generate their own mayhem by failing to put even a single win on the legislative board in their first 6+ months of control. But the hypocrisy and irony involved in that are apparently lost on the junior senator from Arizona. Folks, the GOP's window of opportunity is closing. They need to place, they must place their eyes back on the prize and realize afresh that their opponent is not their own president. It's the left, plain and simple. And if they continue their inability and or unwillingness to accomplish anything with the power they've been granted, rest assured the voters will punish them in next year's midterm elections. In case you missed it on LibertyNation.com this week, check out this one. A bill seeks to secure Second Amendment rights at the cost of state sovereignty by Graham J. Noble. And Trump teams up with senators on a sweeping legal immigration act by Mark Angelides. Up next, Venezuela on fire and why Americans should care, as we're joined by Nathan Steelwater from LibertyNation.com.
Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
Heard here today has been a political spectacle.
We elect these guys to run the country. They're just not doing their job.
This is Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
The fate of 30 million people is now in the hands of a newly empowered, ruthless Marxist dictator in the once great nation of Venezuela, now becoming a hellhole. Joined by Liberty Nation's military and foreign affairs correspondent Nathan Steelwater to discuss how things have reached crisis proportions in Venezuela following a consolidation of power by the Marxist president turned outright dictator Nicolas Maduro after he ordered up elections widely considered fraudulent, which will overturn the Venezuelan constitution and grant de facto absolute power to Mr. Maduro, who one day after the elections ordered his political opponents dragged out of bed in the middle of the night and arrested as the nation literally burns. So, Nathan, thanks for joining in today and answer me, just how bad are things down in Venezuela?
Well, they're quite bad. For one, Venezuela has the highest inflation rate in the world. That's about 741% inflation right now. Astronomical, honestly. And here's the thing. In 1950, Venezuela had the fourth highest GDP per capita in the world. And right now, they have the highest inflation rate. There are rampant shortages of food and basic medical supplies, rolling blackouts that happen sporadically, and you have a government who is ignoring the protests of its people, is ignoring the Congress, which is controlled by the opposition, and has pushed forward a new constitutional electing body, a constituent assembly, to rewrite the Constitution in his favor to consolidate and further hold on to that power.
Well, now, Nathan, when we're talking about Venezuela, we're not talking about a third world banana republic like people might consider it to be. I mean, did Venezuela not have a proud and prosperous history before the reign of Hugo Chavez and Mr. Maduro, who, by the way, began his career as a bus driver?
Venezuela was at one time a, you know, poverty-stricken banana republic. And in the article that I wrote, Venezuela, Poster Child for Socialism Hell, which is on the website, it breaks down generally the history of Venezuela. Now, oil was discovered in the earliest 20th century, and they quickly rose to economic success. Now, the period of time that they had their greatest success was unfortunately under a politically repressive rule. So Venezuela, while it has been economically prosperous, has bounced back and forth between dictators and socialism, so dictators of another kind. And I mean, they've been fairly prosperous, but unfortunately, when you have decades of socialist policy and central economic planning on the government level, you know, consistent attempts to undermine property rights, continue to make the state the one who runs the economy, you're going to have problems. And especially since Venezuela is not a banana republic, it's a petro state. Its entire economy is reliant on oil. And so they suffered from what's called Dutch disease, which is when one sector progresses, but the others decay. And that's what happens when you have state control and they put all their eggs into one oil-filled basket.
Well, let's take this back a step from Nicolas Maduro to Hugo Chavez, who set Venezuela on this, I guess the best way you could put it would be, progressive direction when he consolidated power in the 1990s. How was this Marxist radical Chavez able to come to power in the first place?
Chavez was not the first Marxist, socialist, what have you, to run Venezuela. Right after the coup in 1958 that overthrew Marcos Perez Jimenez, that repressive dictator, a man by the name of Romulo Bentecourt took over as president. And he was an ex-communist. He pushed them towards democracy, but he also pushed them towards socialism. So the seeds of socialism had been planted long before Chavez. But Chavez had tried to take power several times. In the early 90s, he led a botched coup. He went to jail. He was eventually released if they promised to leave the army. His military officers with close ties tried a second coup attempt while he was in jail. He visited Cuba a bunch of times, where, of course, that informed some of his political ideology. And in the late 90s, he won the presidential election. And the reason that he won that is because you had some of the failed policies from his predecessors, and you on the socialist side, and you had failed policies from their predecessors on the extreme, you know, corrupt and crony capitalist side. So Chavez appealed to the lower middle class and the working class, and basically said, "We're going to find a third way, you know, between these two, and we're going to do some social welfare programs." And he promised change, is what he did, but he promised change that would appeal to the masses by doing more social welfare programs. And that's one of the things that I echo in the article that I previously mentioned, that this is how socialist revolutionaries come to power, is they promise a bunch of benefits for the people, and then they use those to make those people reliant on the state, further consolidating that power.
Liberty Nation's military and foreign affairs correspondent Nathan Steelwater coming up on Say What? Debbie Wasserman Schultz may soon be in heap big trouble again, along with many other congressional Democrats, over a rapidly growing scandal, and a leader of the movement for California to secede from the United States says some remarkable things about how Californians are just totally different from the rest of us. We'll be back.
Liberty Nation with Tim Donner. This is Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
Say what? Say what? Say what? One more time.
Say What? The portion of Liberty Nation where we treat you to some of the most wacky, astonishing, and damnable things uttered by politicians and the chattering class. And we played you at the top of the show the most revealing and consequential parts of President Trump's defiant speech to his supporters in the heart of Trump country, West Virginia, the other night. Of course, nothing he says is going to cause the Democrats and some establishment Republicans and never-Trump conservatives to cease and desist in their seemingly single-minded pursuit of removing Trump from office by whatever means avail themselves. And especially with word now of that grand jury ordered up by the special prosecutor Robert Mueller, the supposed link between Russia and Trump is their best bet for kneecapping a duly elected president, which would be a disaster, according to Charles Krauthammer of Fox News, who is no fan of Trump.
I don't think he's very well fit for the presidency, but fitness is not a reason for impeachment and removal. High crimes are. We have a prosecutor looking for high crimes. With Watergate, you started with a crime and then you try to find out right. How it happened. Here, they're looking for a crime. Collusion is unseemly, but it ain't a crime. So you've got a political establishment, mostly Democratic, but there are some Republicans who would like to see him taken out of office. I think that would be a catastrophic mistake. It would cause a rupture in the country where people would say, when we people, the ones who've been abandoned, elect somebody we like, our guy gets taken out. I thought we had a stable democracy.
Well, a stable democracy is not the goal of the militant anti-Trump coalition. Removing him from office is. But absent dramatic proof from the special counsel directly implicating the president, the Democrats would have to win back the House and the Senate because, as we learned during the Bill Clinton impeachment, the House can impeach, but the Senate must convict in order for a president to be removed from office. But while no evidence of any crimes in this whole Russia thing has yet to materialize over more than a year of multiple investigations, there is compelling evidence that a prominent and disgraced Democrat may be embroiled in a scandal with plenty of evidence. Not that you would know it from reading the establishment media, but the embattled Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who was forced to resign as chairwoman of the Democratic National Committee after revelations that she, shall we say, put her thumb on the scale in last year's presidential primary to favor Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders, she's now embroiled in a metastasizing scandal that we're covering on LibertyNation.com, even as the media giants ignore it, except for Kimberly Strassel at the Wall Street Journal, who's put this whole story in perspective. The stuff hit the fan after Imran Awan was arrested at Dulles Airport outside of D.C. a week and a half ago while attempting to board a flight to his native Pakistan. For more than a decade, Awan had been a congressional staffer who worked under top House Democrats, and he had just been accused by the FBI of bank fraud when he was arrested. A litany of court documents accuse Awam and his family of bankruptcy fraud, life insurance fraud, tax fraud, and extortion. Multiple members of the Awam family have been on Democrat payrolls for no-show jobs at lavish salaries for years. And yet, instead of laying low or admitting there was a problem, somehow, Ms. Wasserman Schultz said she was proud to ignore the criminal charges. I'll warn you, the audio is a bit rough.
Not only I believe that I did the right thing, and I would do it again. There are times when you can't be afraid to stand alone, and you have to stand up for what's right. It would have been much easier for me to just cut him loose and say, you know, I'm going to look out for my best interests rather than stand up for what I believe in. But I have to be able to look at myself in the mirror every day. And I'm, if there's one thing I'm going to make sure that I maintain is my integrity.
Her integrity. Wow. Stay tuned, because this scandal is just starting to be unmasked, and we will keep you abreast of all developments at LibertyNation.com. Meanwhile, for something completely different, having just returned from vacationing in California, there's this matter of CalExit, the initiative by Californians to secede from the United States, to become an independent country. They need about 550,000 signatures to put the initiative on the ballot next year. And while secession seems highly unlikely, the comments of one of the leaders of the CalExit movement made some very revealing and remarkable comments about California and the way Californians think of themselves on the Tucker Carlson show on Fox News this week. Shankar Singham, a leader in the movement to make California an independent country, said, or admitted, what many outside California have said, that the state is just not down with what the U.S. is all about.
This is California. We're not the United States. We have, our values are different. We're fundamentally different in the way we act, we speak, and how we think about the world globally, whether it has to do with war, the climate, environment. We are just a different state. We are going to do things that are going to be beneficial for our state, and we disregard what the United States thinks or even their laws. For example, our marijuana, sanctuary cities. If it's good for the state, we're going to do it, regardless of what the federal law is.
Well, that is at least an honest, if shocking, admission. But there's more. The stampede to leave California by the middle class is, according to Mr. Shankar, a welcome development.
In regards to middle class leaving, that's actually a good thing. We need these spots open up for the new wave of immigrants to come up. It's what we do. We're exporting our middle class to the United States. You guys should be thanking us for that.
Hard to believe he would admit that. But California has, in fact, turned into a type of oligarchy with the bookends of rich elites in the technology and entertainment industries and the poor migrants who do their grunt work, while the middle class flees. And it's no wonder, says one of the sharpest minds in the country, columnist and California Victor Davis Hanson.
About 75% of the geography of California is red. And we have this two Californias from San Diego to La Jolla where about 30 million people live. But all of the minerals, the oil, the agriculture is farmed or worked or mined by conservatives. And when they go, they're not leaving to spread California values. They're leaving because they have 13% income tax, the second highest sales tax, third highest gas tax, and yet their schools are rated 46th in the country. And they're, I think Forbes rated our freeways 49th in the country. So we have one out of every four people in California was not born in the United States. And we have 22% below the poverty level, one out of three on welfare. So it's Mississippi and Massachusetts in one state.
Yes, indeed. Mississippi plus Massachusetts equals California. On LibertyNation.com this weekend, why Los Angeles will undoubtedly lose boatloads of money with their decision to host the Olympics in 2024 by Andrew Moran, and the growing problem of overfat Americans by our resident millennial Gabby Fiorina, all on LibertyNation.com.
Liberty Nation with Tim Donner. This is Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
Just talking loud, just say nothing.
And it is time once again to welcome in our regular contributor and old friend, constitutional lawyer and legal correspondent for LibertyNation.com, Scott Cosenza. Hello, Scott.
Hello, Tim.
All right, you wrote a piece on LN on LibertyNation.com this week about what represents, I think, a very significant break from past Justice Department policy. Now, when we think of discrimination, we think of African Americans or Hispanics or other minorities, except Asians, who are mostly loath to assert their rights, and of course, white people. But now Trump has again done something nobody else would do, like the wall, like the trade deals. Mm-hmm. He's going after discrimination against whites and Asians.
Tim, this is Big Lee. This is a big league, by the way. A huge thing. What we learned was that the New York Times has reported that the Department of Justice is now going to enforce the rules that prohibit racial discrimination when whites and Asians are being discriminated against. And previously, even though federal law requires, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 says quite plainly, you're not allowed to consider race, for instance, in who you may admit to your college if you're a government college. Okay. Well, that has since 1964 been the case that if you want to benefit, you know, blacks or Hispanics, then you can do whatever you want to whites and Asians because they haven't been historically discriminated against, even though the law doesn't make that exception. But the Supreme Court carved out an exception for that in 1964 to allow it. But guess what? It doesn't require it. You don't have to discriminate against people because of the color of their skin. And finally, the Trump Justice Department, it seems like, is ready to say to these colleges and universities, at least, stop discriminating against whites and Asians mm-hmm. in favor of blacks and Hispanics. And I think it's a great thing for those of us who really, you know, look up to Martin Luther King's mantra of to judge people by the content of their character and not the color of their skin.
I think we all agree that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was an important step to come to grips with serious discrimination. And part of that was affirmative action, which people mostly embraced at first and have soured on over the years. Here's my question. Where's the statute of limitations on when discrimination right. has reached a point where special policies and set-asides and identities, not gender, but racial identities, no longer become
right.
A factor?
In Grutter B. Vollinger, which is one of the bigger cases in the legacy of Supreme Court jurisprudence on affirmative action. It was 14 years ago. Sandra Day O'Connor wrote, in 25 years, we don't think we'll need these racial set-asides. So that was her putting a date on it. And by the way, I just want to give a sense for people who,
right,
who may not understand the level of preference that we're talking about. For instance,
right.
if you are an Asian person and you're trying to get into medical school, your standardized test scores and GPA have to be about 5 times better than a black person's. It's really staggering what we're doing, especially to Asians. Whites kind of get a bad run, too, but I don't think the numbers there are quite.
The Asians, of course, have a unique combination of very high academic achievement
mm-hmm.
and a great unwillingness to stand out and demonstrate and assert their rights and
right.
say they've been discriminated against like so many other minorities.
And a legacy of discrimination. In other words,
absolutely.
They weren't.
And they have a legitimate legacy.
Right.
That's
yeah.
absolutely
true. It's staggering
true.
What's been done to that population. And, I mean,
they've been penalized for succeeding, Scott. Let's be honest
yes.
about it. I mean, they have succeeded to such a great degree, not just academically, but from a business standpoint, in particular industries where they have thrived.
The answer, Tim, is very simple. From the government perspective, just stop treating people differently because of the color of their skin and their race.
Now, I see this as significant beyond even the decision by the Justice Department because it's very significant in the culture
yes.
and it may represent a reversal of a tide that's been going on for so long in which discrimination against anyone but blacks and perhaps Hispanics was completely overlooked and considered a legitimate remedy
mm-hmm.
for righting historical wrongs.
Tim, I think the tide has to turn at some point, and this may very well be, when we look back through the lens of history, a marker where it did turn, that where people can be judged not by the color of their skin. And I think it has the potential to be a great thing.
But by the content of their character.
Yeah, or their MCAT scores.
And that's
in this
how
case.
You. That's, and that's. Yes, well, that's true. Well, that's how you closed out your piece
mm-hmm.
on LibertyNation.com. You said maybe we will finally get to a point where we again are judging people, or maybe for the first time,
mm-hmm.
judging people strictly
in
on the content
yeah.
Of their character.
Right. Yeah.
We did have palpable discrimination in the past. We had palpable, largely unconstitutional
yes.
solutions
yes.
to it, and now maybe we're heading towards an equilibrium. Now, another story we've covered on LibertyNation.com, we've discussed it here on the show, Evergreen State College, which has actually put itself on the map through outrageous unconstitutional behavior. And now the professor, who is a victim of Evergreen State, filing a huge claim against
the
him.
The liberal progressive professor, by
and
the way.
That's an important point.
Brett Weinstein, yes. Whose only truck with his university is that he didn't want to be discriminated against on the basis of the color of his skin.
Right.
So they had a program there where they wanted white people to stay home from the university based on the color of their skin. This is some sort of minority through the looking glass craziness, if you ask me. And it's
right. White people need not apply.
Exactly. And he said, hey, look, we just shouldn't be judging people based on the color of their skin again. And the lefties exploded, and the administration at Evergreen just catered to the worst of the sort of social justice warrior movement types on campus and basically told him, we can't guarantee your safety. Go ahead and stay home, and did nothing to install order, which is their duty, of course, at the university. So he has sued with a significant federal civil rights lawsuit, $3.8 million they're asking for, and we will certainly follow it.
All right, we'll follow it, but I want a prediction from, not a prediction of what decision will be made, but an assessment of the merits of such of this particular suit.
It has merit, and I believe it will settle in Mr. Weinstein's favor at a sum that we will not be apprised
of. Privy to. They'll settle for something less than 3.8.
They treated him outrageously, and I think the courts will see that.
Well, I think whether you're left or right, when you hit people in the wallet, that's where it really hurts. And these kind of suits are necessary if we have any chance,
it's a vital part of our justice system.
Turning the tide against this progressive overwhelming of our cultural institutions and our colleges.
That's where a lot of the battleground is right now. You know, you get these kids that are railroaded and run off campus for when the kangaroo court. Where do they have recourse? They have it in the civil courts. And so you're right. Making them open up those wallets will hopefully make them change tack.
One of Scott's favorite people in the United States of America, America's toughest sheriff, found guilty of criminal contempt. Joe Arpaio now could be spending time in the hoosegow.
You know, he's somebody who I've been trying to open up people's minds to for a long time, that he is not a great man. I think because he treats people in a demeaning fashion who are involved in the criminal justice system. And for those of us who have spent time working in the criminal justice system, you know that most of the people that are involved in it, even if they've done something bad to another person, they themselves have been, you know, they've had a rough road. And so I don't mean that you should treat them with kid gloves, but you don't need to demean another human being. And that's why I have an issue with him. And also the hypocrisy. So, for instance, he came to fame by housing inmates in tents and making them wear like pink underwear and just sort of feeding them.
Let's set the geographic area.
He is Maricopa County Sheriff, former, which is the largest jurisdiction in Arizona. It's where Phoenix is. And he's just in charge of jailing those inmates, basically. And I think that it's a rural kind of traditional sheriff's, you know, he's the key law enforcement officer for, I think, many of the people in that county, especially before municipal police forces took over. He was that sheriff for over 20 years. So they've seen a lot of change out there. But so Sheriff Joe was famous for these. He was profiled early on 60 Minutes. He was a notorious media hound, courted the media. He loved the limelight and the attention. And he was found guilty of criminal contempt because he was ordered not to try to enforce federal immigration law against people who lived in his district.
Which procedurally is a totally correct ruling, it seems like,
yes.
Because he is not a federal official.
Law enforcement officer.
Right?
Indeed,
I mean,
he's not.
It.
Yeah.
Okay.
The tactics included patrolling Hispanic neighborhoods and stopping people for minor infractions, such as not signaling before a turn, then asking those people for proof of citizenship or naturalization, and arresting those who couldn't provide it. Now, you can imagine how frustrating it would be to run to the market for a quart of milk and neglect to use your turn signal, okay?
Well, it brings to mind the notion that, as I've heard on more than one occasion, that in this life, no matter what you're doing, even if you're sleeping, you're breaking some kind of law.
Yes.
Easy to find something to lock somebody up if you're looking for.
And if you don't have your passport with you, right, and your name's a Hispanic name and you're brown and you live in his county, you've got a problem on your hands. And so he was ordered to stop doing it. He refused to stop doing it. And he's now...
history.
Indeed he is. And good riddance.
All right. Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Tim.
Catch the podcast of this show and the LibertyNation.com podcast, The Uprising, on LibertyNation.com and on fine podcast providers like iTunes, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and all the rest. So that'll do it for this week. We'll be back at you next week. Same time, same station. Till then, this is Tim Donner saying stand up for liberty. And we'll see you next time on Liberty Nation.